Welcome to the Bone Health Basement Tapes, a conversation about the future of bone health. Bone health is the foundation of movement, longevity, and quality of life. But are we doing enough to protect it? The Bone Health Basement Tapes explores cutting-edge osteoporosis prevention, AI-driven diagnostics, and breakthrough bone health technologies. Hosted by experts, each episode features researchers, clinicians, and tech pioneers reshaping how we assess, monitor, and deliver bone health care. Join us as we decode the future of bone health, one conversation at a time. Welcome to the basement. The Bone Health Basement Tapes is a presentation of the American Society of Osteoporosis Providers and the Digital Bone Health Study Group. Welcome back to the Bone Health Basement Tapes. I'm Pete Bianco. In this episode, we're focused on a topic that's gaining overdue recognition across orthopedic and surgical communities, preoperative bone health optimization. We all know that surgical success depends on precision, skill, and planning, but what about the quality of the bone itself? For too long, the role of bone health in surgical outcomes has been underappreciated, yet poor bone quality can lead to hardware failure, delayed healing, and avoidable complications, especially in spine and orthopedic surgeries. The good news? We can do something about it before the first incision is made. Our guest today is someone who's been leading that charge. Dr. Paul Anderson is a professor of orthopedic surgery at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health and a globally recognized expert in spinal surgery and musculoskeletal care. He's also one of the early champions of integrating bone health assessments into surgical planning, helping develop dedicated bone health optimization clinics that are reshaping the standard of care for surgical patients. In today's conversation, we'll explore how to identify at-risk patients, what pre-surgical interventions can make a difference, and why surgeons and healthcare teams need to optimize before heading to the OR. Let's get into it. Good morning, Dr. Anderson, thank you for joining us today on the Bone Health Basement Tapes. I really appreciate it. I want to start this off, bone health preoperative optimization is becoming, an interesting topic of conversation. And I'm just kind of curious, you've been at the forefront of this for some time. How did you get into this? What led you to this particular topic?
Well, as an orthopedic surgeon, we are pretty much undertrained in the whole concept of metabolic bone disease and management thereof. I was a chemical engineer before I went to medical school. And so I was very interested in developing controlled release systems. And back in the 1980s, I published several articles on the use of sodium fluoride in controlled release systems to treat local osteoporosis, such as a vertebral fracture or potentially preventing a vertebral fracture. Kind of akin to vertebroplasty with cement augmentation, except here we had controlled release systems that actually increased bone mass. This actually worked quite well, but we couldn't get NIH funding, so I ended up stopping that kind of research. So I've always been interested in the field. And then personally, as a spine surgeon, I treat a lot of patients with osteoporotic-related spinal fractures.
Right.
And I start out by reflecting on my own experience of surgical management of the osteoporotic fracture patient, be it for burst type fractures with neurologic compression or major deformities. And my complication rate was 120%, meaning a lot of patients had more than one complication. And these were just four simple complications: death, neurologic, hardware failure, or infection.
Right.
And it was 120%. So I realized that, hey, we really need to do something different.
Right.
And that led me to be involved with the whole concept of secondary fracture care through the AOA Own the Bone program. And as leader of that program, I really developed the concept of bone health optimization, where we could apply the same principles of secondary fracture prevention to pre-op bone health optimization to try to improve spine surgery outcomes.
Right.
And then I had to educate myself again about what total hip arthroplasty is going through and realize that they have the same problems too, although not to the magnified level that they are in spine, but they certainly have the same problems. And so that has led me to develop this kind of program to address the underdiagnosis and undertreatment of osteoporosis in elective orthopedic surgery.
So when did you start doing this clinically?
Yeah, so at the University of Wisconsin, where I currently work, we started a fracture liaison service in 2016. We developed the program. 2017, we started seeing patients. And it was about 2019, we started adding the pre-op optimization in spine surgery patients.
Right, yeah.
I and a few of my partners would pick patients who we thought had osteoporosis and then started sending them to the FLS coordinator and start getting them treatment. That has grown. So now our FLS team is actually doing more bone health optimization than they are
Then they are secondary
fracture.
fracture, yeah.
And that is what's going on across the country is that the spine surgeons have realized the importance of this and are getting their patients checked out for bone health and getting them treated preoperatively. Unfortunately, less so in the arthroplasty surgeons.
Right. And look, it seems to me like arthroplasty surgeons are starting to understand it, but they're behind the curve from the spine world, it appears to me. Do you think that this is going to move into arthroplasty as well to the degree that it is in spine?
I don't know if I'll reach the degree, but it will significantly improve in the future as adverse outcomes are tied to reimbursements.
Right.
Then yes, this will improve because if you have a periprosthetic fracture in the global period after total joint surgery, and that patient needs to be readmitted or the reoperated on or the admission is prolonged, then you are losing money on your bundled care or capitated care kind of program. And once the financial ramifications of these kinds of complications are determined and acknowledged by administration, then they will try to force these kind of programs
Right.
on
Yeah.
orthopedic surgeons.
Right. It seems to me that's coming, right?
I don't want to comment on what the government's going to do.
Dudley, why don't you jump in here and,
Dr. Anderson, do you think that at some point, given the aging population and the proclivity that we're having younger patients for, either spine or arthroplasty surgery, as we have fewer surgeons, that resource to do primary surgery is going to be stretched. Do you feel that preoperative optimization is the way to help reduce these risks further downstream, 8, 10, 12, 15 years downstream, to prevent some of these fractures or hardware failure down the road, more so than what it is today.
Let me make sure I understand your question. But traditionally, when we talk about pre-op bone health optimization, we're talking about assessing the bone health prior to surgery. I
Right.
think you're referring to what do we do longitudinally on these patients who have major spine implants, who have total hip and total knee replacements. Because if they're in the age group, they are going to be losing bone density. There's probably a negative effect on the implants on the bone around the implant. For instance, you continue to shed bone after a total hip or total knee replacement in the femur. And you also lose bone through the natural aging process. And which means that if you start with an arthroplasty at a younger age, by the time you're older, 2 or 3 decades older, you're going to have even more bone loss and make you much more subject to a periprosthetic fracture or loosening, something like that. So that is yet a second question, and I'm beginning to address that, but I haven't found a good way. I would make a proposal is that it's typical for patients who have arthroplasties that they be seen every 5 years or 10 years by their orthopedic surgeon, x-ray performed. And at that point, a bone health assessment is done to kind of see, have you developed osteoporosis in the near time? And if you have, obviously get you referred to the proper resource, whatever that be in your community, back to primary care or maybe to your FLS program. So I hope I answered your question.
Yeah, I guess it seems like in the system that I was in, once they got into bone health, that bone monitoring became a long-term function of the FLS or the bone health unit.
Yeah, let me address it. That's a very good point. When we had developed our FLS service, and this would apply for bone health optimization as well, is we envisioned doing the initial assessment, getting the patient on the appropriate initial treatment, and getting them through the initial treatment. For instance, if it was a anabolic drug, yeah, we'd follow them for 1 or 2 years till the anabolic drug stopped and we transitioned to something else. And then we would return the patient with a detailed treatment plan to the primary care doctor. We found that did not work. And the primary care doctor did not want to continue the treatment and refer the patient back to us. And so all of a sudden, we had no way to get rid of patients, but we kept accumulating patients. And that just made it impossible to see new patients. So our only thing we could do was add more personnel and kind of had to give up the idea that this was going to be a primary care job. Now, I work at a university system. It might be totally different in a small community practice where a primary care physician is used to taking on more stuff that they might be uncomfortable with. But I could tell you at the big academic centers and wherever I talk, everybody says the same thing. Yeah, we can't get rid of patients. We can't get primary care take them back. And there aren't enough other specialties, endocrine, rheumatology, geriatrics who are qualified to take care of bone health. There's not enough of those. And the endocrine, unfortunately, is now taking care of obesity drugs so much that they have even less time for bone drugs. Even though the obesity drugs are going to create more bone problems.
This is another one that's going to pay dividends in orthopedics down the road, I think.
Well, it'd be very similar to transplants. Transplants do great till their joints fall apart or they fracture something or the joints get infected. And then the orthopedic surgeons are forced to take care of these kind of long-term complications in very difficult patients. And I think we're going to see some of the same thing with the LP inhibitors.
One of the challenges for preoperative optimization in general is, especially with the arthroplasty community, they want to slide that preoperative optimization in somewhere between the time they schedule surgery and before the patient is in the surgery suite, which normally is 2 to 4 weeks tops. Spine has been more open to saying, I would rather have an optimized patient 6 months or 12 months from now and do my surgery once rather than do it 2 or 3 times. How do you see opportunities for us to move that initial encounter further upstream in the patient process through orthopedics or the patient journey through healthcare in general, move it up to more of a primary osteoporosis identification stage?
Well, one way would be at the first visit a patient comes in, they're evaluated for bone health and a decision made very rapidly that, hey, before we talk about your arthroplasty, we got to assess your bone health because you may need optimization.
Right.
So getting criteria or screening criteria that's easy to use that can identify that patient immediately. It is, I think, actually quite rare to have somebody come in and first visit say, you need a joint replacement, bam, you're going to have surgery in 3 weeks.
Right.
Usually there's some kind of delays. And I just use the analogy, if you're diabetic and we check a hemoglobin A1C and your hemoglobin A1C is 12, and you go do a total hip arthroplasty and they have some kind of complications, I think you just created malpractice, and that you're going to step back and delay surgery. And this is absolutely no different than other optimization programs, and many of which will require delays of surgery, and you just have to accept that. If you're looking at it from the arthroplasty surgeon, they're always worried, hey, golly, I'm not going to have any cases to operate on. But you actually think about it, you're still going to have a steady state of patients coming in who get surgery. When you institute the program, you may have some delays, but eventually they'll all go away because the people who have been optimized for 2 months are now
We'll be
shot
ready.
back up. So it's a short term, and it's not going to make a difference in the long term. It's a matter of will, is how important is this to your patients, and do you want to take this project on? The spine surgeons, a lot of them get it. I can't say around the country how many percent of, let's just divide it out by fusions. What percent of patients are getting assessed for bone health prior to fusions? Certainly at big centers where they do a lot of surgeries, many of those have bone health programs now. But I don't know about smaller community hospitals and how they're doing with this. They don't have the resources, they don't have referral networks, maybe not access to DEXA machines. So there's a lot of barriers to doing this, most of which, to be honest, is on the surgeon not knowing that this is our responsibility and taking ownership for it.
Do you see orthopedics as being the entity that finally owns osteoporosis?
Well, I've been talking about this at nationally to leaders, is that I think it's a would be a wonderful idea if orthopedic departments develop a division of bone health within orthopedics. And this is a multi-specialty thing. It's very similar to sports medicine. If you're familiar with sports medicine at big centers, is you'll have surgeons, but you'll have a probably an equal or greater number of physicians who are not surgeons, but they've been trained in sports medicine. For instance, family practice doctors, physiatrists, and we have three pediatricians who are sub-trained in sports. So our sports division is very multidisciplinary, let alone with athletic trainers as well. And so I think the same model would work in bone health. I don't know, I don't think you're going to get pushback from internal medicine. They like to be territorial, but since they're not doing this anyway, and they don't have practitioners interested in it, I don't see this
Yeah, they
as.
don't seem to want to do it.
Therefore, like our endocrine, when we hire a new endocrine, they give them some bone clinic time. But nobody else wants it other than the one person whose research interest is in bone physiology. She likes to do it. Nobody else in endocrine wants to do it, nor are they that qualified. They actually do a much worse job than my PA who does it in my clinic. So orthopedics is a good spot, mainly because we have the patients.
Right.
We have, we virtually touch the majority of fracture patients. And in spine, you could include neurosurgeons in that as well, of course. But we treat a lot of most of the spine fractures, and we treat all the hip and everything else pretty much. So we have the fracture patients, but people don't realize there are more people getting total joint replacements in the United States than actually have fragility fractures. And one third of the patients with undergoing joint arthroplasty, greater number in spine, have osteoporosis. So
Right.
we have a large pool of patients that we can affect. I'm not suggesting that that this orthopedic division of bone health reach out and start doing primary preventative care, because I do still think that's a primary care problem, although we could offer secondary specialty services for those complex patients who primary care doesn't feel. For instance, we asked our primary care doctors what drugs they would feel comfortable prescribing for osteoporosis, and about half of them said alendronate would be okay. About 2% said denosumab, and 1% said an anabolic drug. 1% of our primary care. So we need to have backup for those kinds of patients.
I see orthopedics, just to put my own slant on this, if we start doing preoperative optimization further upstream from surgery, it really doesn't look any different than primary osteoporosis prevention.
No, actually, my protocol is applying what you should be done from a primary care standpoint to a spine surgery patient. That's my current protocol. Now, to be honest, I think preventing fractures is an easier thing than to preventing complications associated with spine surgery. In other words, spine surgery is introducing variables that increase the risk of bone-related complications. However, I currently, or we are at the university here, our protocol is using the protocol you would use for primary prevention. In other words, if a patient is in a high-risk group, they're probably going to get a anti-resorptive type of drug, denosumab, or perhaps an anabolic, depending on some of their risk factors. And then the very high risk are going to get an anabolic treatment.
So, if I hear this right, you would be okay changing the discussion from how do I prevent a secondary fracture and changing the discussion to how do I prevent any fracture?
And well, in terms of the perioperative patient and a bone-related complication associated with my surgery. And that would be in the spine. We have this problem of proximal junction kyphosis where we put instrumentation and they fall apart above it. We also have problems with pedicle screw loosening, hardware coming out. In arthroplasty, something called aseptic loosening is a problem and is correlated to osteoporosis. Subsidence of implants, revision surgery, but the biggest thing now on everybody's mind is periprosthetic fractures.
Fractures, yeah.
On the other hand, if you want, you should also include other fragility fractures, because have you helped the patient? You did a nice hip replacement on them, but 3 months later they fall and break their other hip, where you miss this opportunity to intervene and try to prevent that. I mean, do you think you really helped that patient with that hip surgery when they still end up with some other untoward event? Now, it's not directly related to your hip surgery, although some people might argue it is, as something like 35% of people after hip and knee replacement sustain a fall in the first year. Okay, well, what creates fractures? Well, it's a combination of poor bone and falls.
So, I mean, part of our challenge, I think, is when I talk to primary care and you talk about primary prevention, they're like, we just don't have bandwidth to do any of this. And I don't know that it's an unwillingness. I think it's an absolute lack of bandwidth.
I agree. There is that, but there's also so much conflicting advice from guidelines and appropriate use criteria. Every organization creates their own set of guidelines. So it makes things very confusing for primary care, which ends up just paralyzing them or creating inertia or friction in the whole process. I know that we occasionally will get a patient started on treatment, and the primary care doctor says, "Well, that's not indicated," and stops it. So clearly, there's a knowledge base. Communication also sometimes is a problem. The primary care doesn't even know the patient had a fracture, and that's on the system. We found that something like 20% of the primary care notes that go back after a hospitalization for like a fracture go to the wrong primary care doctor. And we just can't keep track of that. The patient doesn't know who they are. Their last time they saw him was 5 years ago, and they retired or moved since then. And it's very hard to make sure we're communicating properly.
Have you found any secrets to improve that communication and handoff of the patient back to primary care?
No.
I was hoping for a more robust discussion, but no,
Well, let me
we're.
tell you, we asked primary care how they would like to be notified of something like this. And there are like four different ways, depending on the primary. It's like me. You can send something to me on Facebook. Well, I'm never going to get it because I don't have Facebook account. You could send it to me by text page, and I might get it in 3 or 4 days, or chat box. I might get it in 3 or 4 days. Because I don't look at that all the time. But if you send it by email, I usually will respond within 24 hours, unless I'm traveling, and then it might be a week. So everybody's different, and where primary care is inundated with so much stuff already that it's hard for them to keep track, and everybody does it differently. They prioritize their in-basket differently than email and so it's very hard to know how to best communicate with people.
How can we help surgeons that or FLS services that have access to incidental CT scans? What advice can we give them as far as gleaning information from that CT for bone density?
Yeah. Well, let me start by just talking about how does one screen a patient for osteoporosis in orthopedic office? And then that will be one of the parameters. So I look at this as being a detective, is you have to look for things that tip one off to the likelihood of having osteoporosis. And it is, obvious ones that are well known are risk factors, patients on 40 pounds of steroids a day. Okay, we know that's bad. The patient smokes four packs of cigarettes a day. They have rheumatoid arthritis. And we go through those risk factors. Those are well established. One of the simplest is prior fracture. If you had a fragility fracture in the last in the last 3 to 5 years, your chance of having a bad outcome of orthopedic surgery, including spine and arthroplasty, is like 3 to 4 fold those who don't have that. So that's a very simple one. And I think orthopedic surgeons are qualified to take a history of fractures. I hope. Now, another one is to ask, have you ever been diagnosed with osteoporosis? It turns out a lot of patients have been diagnosed with osteoporosis, but have not been appropriately treated for osteoporosis. And then you get into imaging. When we look at imaging, we do get a sense that, hey, this bone looks kind of crappy here. The cortices are thin. There's a lot of geometry of the proximal femur you can look at, thinning of the cortices, widening of the canal. is so-called door classification. And you get a gestalt, you know, this bone doesn't look quite right. And so that ought to tip you off. Then you can use opportunistic measurements of existing data sets. And, you know, CT scan is a huge biomarker for other things than it was originally designed or ordered for. For instance, maybe a patient came into the ER with a rule out kidney stone. Well, they got a nice abdominal CT scan and pelvis CT scan. Well, we can look at their bone, and you can use that CT data to do measurements and estimate bone mineral density. And I use the word estimated, they're not the same thing, but it's an estimation, very simple thing. Most surgeons know how to use a PAC system for this, and you draw a region of interest in a very specific area. And in the spine, if that region of interest gives you a mean, what's called Hounsfield units, a Hounsfield unit is a normalized X-ray attenuation coefficient. So in other words, how much X-ray energy is absorbed in a tissue irradiated that was irradiated. And if that Hounsfield unit is less than 110 in the spine, that patient likely has osteoporosis, and that would mean maybe send that patient off. You can do it with the proximal femur. The numbers are a bit different. It's technically more challenging to get a reliable measure there, but that has been reported as well. And then even people using MRI, lumbar MRI, under the assumption that as you get osteoporotic, you get more fat content in the MRI imaging. And if you use a fat sensitive sequence, which is called a T1 weighted sequence, then the signal intensity of the vertebral bodies, which again you can measure in a region of interest, goes up, has to be normalized. So you normalize it to CSF, so you get a region of interest in CSF in the spine. And you take that ratio, and if that ratio is greater than 3, they likely have osteoporosis, or they're at risk for osteoporosis. So you could use these opportunistic scanners or scanning scans that have been done for other purposes and identify patients. It's very powerful. It's frequently done now in the spine surgery world for sure. Another way is using plain X-rays with machine language learning, where people have software programs that can estimate osteoporosis based on a variety of bone characteristics from plain X-rays and give you a binary outcome, likely osteoporotic, not likely osteoporotic. And that's very interesting because that could be used at the time of initial evaluation, because most patients getting spine surgery or joint arthroplasty are going to have plain X-rays. And boy, it'd be really nice to pull up the X-ray and a big red flag shines at you and says, this looks like osteoporosis. So that's something that's coming down the road. We'll see how that works out to help us screen patients. But the surgeon has to understand the importance and take the additional time to do this detective work to identify. I kind of think of it, okay, you're playing a game of Clue here, and I got to go find out if osteoporosis was part of this murder scene here. I got to go in each room and find out, oh, there's family history. Oh, there's drugs. Oh, they had a DEXA 2 years ago and it was crappy. Oh, they had Hounsfield units, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a whole list of things that during the assessment can be done to determine if that patient is likely to have osteoporosis and therefore would warrant further diagnostic testing.
What do you do to try to screen out or screen in people with vitamin D deficiency, which is going to impact the immune system? People with hyperparathyroid, in my practice, about 40% of hardware failure or lack of biologic ingrowth, we found those people to be hyperparathyroid, which is pretty easy to treat.
Yeah. So for the patients who meet threshold for getting more bone health optimization, then one of the things we do is a 25-hydroxy D vitamin D level. For all patients who are going to have surgery should be given 2 to 5,000 units of vitamin D up until their surgery. And then after surgery, they can go to a more of a maintenance dose. So that's part of our program is to institute just vitamin D supplementation for all patients. Because as you said, there is an association, I'm going to use the word association, between immune dysfunction, increased surgical site infections, and low vitamin D across surgical specialties. I would only use the word association. I don't think it's a cause and effect necessarily, as people with vitamin D deficiency also tend to have a lot of other medical problems that may lead to that. But it's so a simple thing and harmless and low cost that it makes sense to do that across the board. Now, we only test those who need further bone health optimization. In the same way, we would screen out for things like hyperparathyroidism. You're correct. 4% of our bone health optimization program patients, and we've treated like 700 of them here, have had primary hyperparathyroidism and needed not spine surgery, they needed parathyroid surgery first. And there's a whole other list of secondary causes that some of which are modifiable. Now, obviously, there are ones that are not modifiable. For instance, chronic renal failure or something, or they're on steroids that can't be stopped. Okay, well, we got to manage it for that. But many patients have treatable secondary causes for osteoporosis. And in fact, if you look at things like non-unions of orthopedic surgery, something like 40% of them have some form of endocrinopathy. So it's very common.
And that's what we found in our practice was it was really incredibly common. Where are we going to find the army of patient or of practitioners to treat this tsunami of patients that we could create just from preoperative optimization?
Well, it's up to each surgeon to develop a program that's going to work for their locale. Now, if you're in a small community hospital in the middle of Iowa, then maybe you need to work with the primary care doctors, educate them about what you're trying to do, and see if they're willing to step in. If you're in more metropolitan areas, you find bone health specialists in town who are willing to take these patients on. If you're in a big multi-specialty group, then develop a program within your group. And frankly, the most effective program for providing secondary fracture prevention as well as bone health optimization is when the program is aligned with the orthopedic department. And the advantages there are several. First of all, they understand what we're trying to do. But most importantly, that's where the patients start life, and that means that the patients are there and we need easy access. And so it's very easy when I'm seeing a patient to get a patient in my FLS program. So creating these within the department and how do you do that? Well, it's a complicated process. You have to get administration on board and you have to design the program, what kind of patients you're going to include. You got to train the people up. Frankly, this is an ideal position for mid-level providers for the most part. You don't need MDs or DOs. You just have an interested, smart mid-level provider. Does a great job in handling 98% of these patients because they're pretty straightforward. Now, when they start having complex endocrine issues, then you need a refer to have access to endocrine and other, in our case, some other chronic renal failure have to go to nephrology as well. But you have to have some experts back up for sure. But most of the time, the FLS coordinators that are APPs do a great job.
How much pushback do you get from others in the orthopedic realm that this is osteoporosis for them is always a net loser for financially?
Well, that's always the number one barrier to starting these programs is, oh my God, we're going to lose money. We got a PA out there, can't go to surgery and make assistance fees. And, it's one of the other challenges is it's providing chronic care in a specialty that's used to providing much more acute care. So orthopedic
Right.
surgeons typically are not involved in maintenance or chronic care. Here you are. So this is a little bit of a culture change for the clinic. And we found that. I didn't pick that up when I started ours. So it did require a little bit of re-education of everybody about that and changing people's expectations. That means administrators. If you have the right person, there is no shortage of patients, and you can make this thing relatively revenue neutral. The thing is that the FLS program and bone health optimization will generate a lot of income for the quote system. Depends on what you mean by system. If you're in private practice, it's not generating as much as like the University of Wisconsin health system, where we generate a lot of income because we send people to therapy, we send them to infusion centers, we give them injections in the office, we order a bunch of lab tests that they bill five times as much as they cost, and DEXA scans and X-rays, referrals to other specialties. 4% of our patients end up getting parathyroid surgery. So, okay, that's bringing money into the institution. That's oftentimes credit. They're just looking at revenue by the provider, cost that the provider is given, and they're looking at it a very simplistic way.
So getting that metric right from a C-suite standpoint is critical to success and the ability to expand the program, it sounds like.
Yeah, and as soon as we showed that we were highly profitable, we got another person right away. It
There you go, right?
was pretty impressive once we showed, hey, we're making a lot of money when we started including these other things, particularly on the drugs. They realized, ooh, maybe if we had more of that, we'd make more money. And I'm not kidding you, within like 2 days, all of a sudden, yeah, why don't you guys go get another? We got approved for another PA.
It's quite a motivator, isn't it?
Well, there's two things that would money and regulations. So
Right.
if it's
Yeah.
regulated that you have to do this, let's say secondary fracture prevention, if that's an absolute regulation, then it's going to have to happen because it'll be tied to reimbursement. CMS did pass a rule this year that patients who sustain hip fractures have to refer to primary care for their bone health. Now, they didn't put any mandate on primary care what they're supposed to do. It's just that the surgeon has to put in their discharge summary, oh, you need to assess bone health because this patient had a hip fracture. So, and why, and they actually didn't say or FLS. So, we're in the situation where we're telling primary care they got to do this, but we're going to do it for them.
Right.
Even so, it makes us not kind of technically in compliance, which is crazy. But that's the government.
And we decided not to go there today. So, what else should people know about setting up an FLS service that we haven't talked about? What's that one golden nugget that you've kept back
Well,
from
you
us?
need to have leadership. And for the FLS service, you have to have a surgeon who is passionate about doing this. It would be best if you had a medical doctor who has some expertise in this field. And you need to have a key administrator who has the power to make things happen. So I kind of think of those as the trifecta. Having those three people, then you can make this thing work. If you don't have, you could do it with just a surgeon and administrator, but you might be missing something when you start really developing the protocols and things. So it's nice to have that third medical doctor. It's nice to have a surgeon. Certainly endocrine could do this in their thing, in their clinic, and there are clinics that do it this way, but then they're not going to get as much buy-in from the surgeons as they would if you have everybody involved at the beginning. So I think you got to find the key leaders. Where a lot of the FLS programs have failed is when one of the key leaders leaves or retires. So you got to make sure those key leaders are going to be around for a while, or there is a suitable transition plan. But that's the most important thing. Without the key leaders, you're going nowhere. And this could be a group. Like I met people in Stevens Point, small town in central up. We're with Madison, where I work, is southern Wisconsin. Anything north of me is up north. And these guys are up, I don't know, near the Arctic Circle or something. And
I've actually been there. It's nice.
it is nice. I'm just joking.
It's very nice.
And they have like eight orthopedic surgeons at their community hospital there, all in one group. Now they're affiliated with the hospital. But one of their PAs did half-time FLS.
Yeah.
He just took that on for the group, trained up. At a financial sacrifice to the group to some degree, in the sense that he wasn't as available for OR help where he generates more income. But the group said this is worth whatever sacrifice they made and how they distribute money to do it because nobody else in their community did it. So those kind of models work really well. And I'd be interested to Dudley, what your experience with this kind of thing is in smaller communities. Have you seen that?
Everyone, the successful ones typically have done this for altruistic reasons.
Yeah, it's the right thing to do.
It's the right thing to do. They don't understand the metrics of profitability for an FLS service. But they'll get it started. Somebody will sacrifice and get things going to get the community engaged. And oftentimes they become the de facto experts in the community for everything osteoporosis.
Yeah, right. That's good. I mean, that helps their office because it brings patients to their office and they're more likely to stay within the office when they do develop orthopedic problems. Can we go over one more topic? I suggest maybe.
Sure, absolutely.
One of the other barriers is how to decide how long a delay is needed from surgery to treat
Right.
bone health. So this is something that is of great concern to both patients and surgeons. Presumably patients are seeing a surgeon because they have pain and/or dysfunction and would like to move on with their life. From a surgeon's perspective, we want to provide timely care if at all possible. How long do you need? Well, it depends on the risk of the patient and the risk of the surgery. So, if you have a very high risk fracture patient, according to the current ACE guidelines, BHOF guidelines, those patients, in my opinion, require a significant delay in surgery for preoperative optimization with an anabolic drug. And typical is 3 months. And the reason 3 months is selected is you can, with anabolic drugs, you can see a statistical improvement in bone mineral density by 3 months in the spine and hip. And you also can see a significant reduction by more than 40, 50% in fracture risk with those drugs at 3 months. So a reduction in fracture risk is implies an improvement in bone strength, which is ultimately what we're really interested in orthopedics. Also, if you look at how bone physiology is working with bone turnover markers, you see that by 3 months, those turnover markers are in the very favorable range, where you're seeing a nice separation between positive bone formation and its effect on bone resorption. So bone formation is exceeding bone formation or bone resorption greatly. Now, in more complex surgeries, like the spinal deformity surgery, for instance, there is a really nice paper out of New York City that did 6 months of teriparatide in patients undergoing more than seven level fusion. So these are adult spinal deformities over the age of 50. And that took the osteoporotic patients, got that treatment. They had the same complication rate as patients who had normal bone mineral density at the time of their surgery. So, in other words, 6 months of teriparatide normalizes the patient's risk for osteoporotic related complications to the patients
Interesting.
who were normal.
Yeah.
So maybe for those bigger surgeries, 6 months is a at least one time point. Unfortunately, in that study, we don't know if 3 months would have given the same results or not, but I do know 6 months for those bigger operations works very well. Now, interestingly, when we present this delay of surgery to patients, they've accepted it pretty well, and you have to explain to them why. We want to avoid you coming in for secondary surgery, and they actually begin to appreciate this process. We've had a number of patients say, nobody's ever talked to me about this before, about their bone health in general, let alone risk of complications with surgery. So the acceptance by the patient has been much better than I predicted. I thought we'd have patients screaming at us and giving us zero on our prestation scores and things. So, like the same way when I tell a patient, no, I'm not giving you narcotics, they storm out of the room and get mad at you. But no, that's not true at all. They actually, and believe it or not, we get better compliance with medication on this population than I do on the secondary fracture prevention.
Yeah, because they want an operation at the end of the day.
Yeah.
What is going on from a fellowship standpoint to train the surgeons that this is another component of that overall risk assessment preoperatively for their patients that ultimately they still have control of?
Yeah. Well, it's obviously through training and education. Fellows and residents, are still kind of being trained with a preceptor model. They're looking at their mentors and they're going to follow a practice of the mentors. If the mentors are doing this, then they're going to do it. We also, pretty much every national meeting now will have a bone health, the osteoporosis kind of symposium talks on this subject. So there's a lot of education going out. The AOA actually has identified future leaders program. These are generally fourth and fifth year residents who their chairman really think they're going to be academic and become in leadership positions. And each year we discuss with them how to set up an FLS program in their institution with the hope that these people will go out and become members of centers and develop such programs. So we're doing a lot on the educational front, things like this. I do webinars, symposium, virtual things all the time on this subject. We're publishing a lot of papers on this topic. It's seemingly of a lot of interest to everybody. So hopefully people are going to be more attuned to it. But I know just from discussing to my fellows who go out, particularly if they go out in non-academic centers, they're frustrated because they don't have access to the kind of program that I have, that we've created here. They kind of expect this to be available when they join up, and it's not. And so they get quite frustrated. I just say, start your own or reach out in the community, find somebody who will do this with you.
Yeah.
Those are your, you don't have very many other options.
Well, this has been great, Dr. Anderson. I really appreciate your time. I mean, it's one of these kind of topics that's seemingly getting a lot more attention. There's clearly a need for it. So your leadership in this is truly appreciated. And thanks for joining us today. We really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Yeah, my pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Thanks. The Bone Health Basement Tapes are a presentation of the American Society of Osteoporosis Providers and the Digital Bone Health Study Group. Check us out at www.theasop.org.